I'm Bruce, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bruce.
It is my honor tonight to introduce the speaker. I met her about 5 years ago at a meeting in town here, and we became friends. And I think when we first met, I walked out into the parking lot, and she came over to me and asked me about surgery that I had had. And I says, I don't know this woman. How does she know anything about this stuff? And she played this whole thing. She was a mind reader and a psychic and all this kind of stuff, and I fell for it. But anyhow, we became friends, very good friends, and I call her my sister. She calls me her brother, and there's a story behind that. Real quick story, that this meeting that we were attending for quite a while, not attending together, but just happened to be there at the same time, there was somebody there that was harassing her or giving her a hard time or something like that, and I grabbed him after the meeting, and I said, if you don't leave my sister alone, you and I are going to have a problem. Well, the word got out that we were brother and sister. So for well over a year, people thought we were. But anyhow, she's got great recovery that I know of. I mean, in my opinion, she's just become a really good friend, I guess is the best way I can put it to you. And with that, my sister, Tina H.
Everybody, I'm Tina, an alcoholic. There is no doubt in my mind that I am an alcoholic. And I heard when I came into these rooms that if I stayed here long enough, I would not only hear my story, but I would read my story. And it took me a little over 3 years to finally read my story. And as time has gone on, I'm more and more convinced that even though this book was written in the 30s, that they were writing about the future Tina. So I'm going to read part of it. It says, the mental twist that led up to my drinking began many years before I actually took a drink. For I'm one of those whose history proves conclusively that my drinking was a symptom of a deeper trouble. Through my efforts to get down to the causes and conditions, I stand convinced that my emotional illness has been present from my earliest recollection. I never did react normally to any emotional situation. The medical profession would probably tell me I was conditioned for alcoholism by the things that happened to me in my childhood, and I'm sure they would be right as far as they go. But AA has taught me that I'm the result of the way I reacted to what happened to me as a child. What is much more important to me is that AA has taught me that through this simple program, I may experience a change in the reaction pattern that will indeed allow me to match calamity with serenity. And I truly believe that with every fiber of my being. A lot of people ask me, especially in the program where I'm from, they don't believe me when I tell them I'm from the South. I was born right here in Nashville at Baptist Hospital. I have two older brothers and a younger sister. But from an early age, I was too much. I was too tall, too skinny. I had too many freckles. My hair was too red. And believe this or not, I talked too much. I also talk very fast, and that's not indicative of a true Southerner, but I do, and that's. I now no longer try to fit in. I am who I am. And my parents were from the area, and they married, and they had a very volatile relationship, and there was a lot of fighting. People say you can't, most people can't remember their early childhood, and I do. I can remember at age 3, I remember where I lived. Explicitly. The color of the walls. I remember my best friend that lived next door, his name was Rory. I was age 3. I remember songs on the radio. I remember the clothes I wore. I even remember Christmas one year that Santa Claus didn't come. And my only childhood memory of my biological father, was of him chasing my mother out the back door, around the apartment, back through the front door. And this went on and on and on. And then the next door neighbor screaming at my father to stop, and him stopping and going to my mother's car, and he raised the hood and pulled out all the wires to her car. My parents divorced shortly thereafter. My mother remarried. I don't know exactly how old I was. It wasn't very long after that. I was probably 5 and a half when she remarried. My stepfather was a staff sergeant in the Army, and he treated us like his soldiers. He actually treated our dogs better than he treated us kids. There was a lot of physical abuse and a lot of mental abuse, emotional abuse. And later on, sexual abuse. So I learned in an early age to do what was asked of me so that I didn't get a beating. And I excelled at school and did pretty well. I remember the first time I ever drank, I was probably 11. I didn't like it. Didn't drink again until I was in college. I did not drink alcoholically from the get-go. The relationship of my mother and my stepfather, again, it was a very abusive a relationship. And finally, by the age of when I was 17, my mother filed for divorce. My two older brothers were kicked out of the house by my stepfather, and it was just me and my sister. My mother filed for divorce. And my stepfather, I've come to know, was a very sick man. But, you know, as a child, you don't know any differently. I just knew that I wasn't allowed to have any friends to my home. And as I got older, I didn't want to have any friends to my home. I was ashamed. And I didn't know until I was much older, after I had my own children, when I talked to a childhood friend, that the adults in our neighborhood knew about the abuse that was happening in my home. But back then, people didn't get involved. And whether or not my life would have turned out any differently, I don't know. This program has taught me, you know, I can't do anything about the past, and the future hasn't happened yet, so I have to live in today. So anyway, my mother had filed for a divorce, and I was at the time working at Opryland Theme Park, and I was trying to help my mother put food on the table and pay the utilities, because at that point, since they had filed for divorce, the only thing my stepfather was doing was making the mortgage payment. And so I went to work that morning, and that evening I had called home to see, I wasn't driving yet. I didn't have a car. There was no money for any of that kind of stuff. So I called home to see if my mother would pick me up if I worked a second shift. And my grandmother answered the phone, and I heard a lot of men's voices in the background, and like sounded like a radio. And what I found out when I got home was it was the policemen. There was a lot of policemen. My stepfather had tried to kill my mother. And the DA ruled it as a justifiable homicide because he had apparently had written a note. He was going to commit suicide and kill my mother. But he had taken so many pills that his reaction to her trying to get away from him was such that when he grabbed her, there was a tussle, the gun went off, and he died. So when I got home, I found my mother half beaten to death and his brain splattered all over the bedroom wall. You know, I never have in my entire life, and still don't to this day, ever have wished somebody dead, but things were a lot quieter at my house. So I was a senior in high school. I went to McGavick right down the street here, and I started college before I even graduated high school because my stepfather my entire life told me I was not worth anything and I would never be anything, and I was out to prove him wrong. So even though he had died, I decided I would graduate high school and I would go to college and I would make something of myself, and I set out to do just that. So I went to college and I worked full time. I put myself through college. I didn't have the grades or the, you know, again, we're talking about the 80s. I just didn't come from a family that had the wherewithal or the resources that kids today have. I did qualify for some grants, but not any scholarships. I didn't have, you know, my high school counselor told me, I can't remember what she told me that I should do for a living. It was something with not very much ambition, if you will. And so I was out to prove her wrong as well. So anyway, I went to college and I worked full time. And when I graduated college, I got a job in my chosen profession, which was travel. I started in the travel industry, and because I wanted to see the world. It was an office job, and I thought it was glamorous. So I set about climbing the corporate ladder. I worked at the same company for the first 5 years, and then I'd pretty much gotten as far as I could go at that company. I transferred to the company that I ended my career with. That company that I retired from, I was with them for 25 years. So during all that time, I still had not drank very much. First of all, I didn't have the time when I was in college. I was working full time. I didn't have enough time to sleep, much less go out to bars with my, you know, friends. And on top of that, you know, I was still trying to help my mother. I was living with her and trying to help her make the mortgage payment every month. I was saving money to put tires on my car. I didn't have money to go out and drink. And I didn't trust a lot of people, understandably so. I now know that that was very normal. But and I still have a hard time trusting a lot of people. Anyway, I drank a little bit in college. I remember going out with my girlfriend one time, and we got pretty drunk on some Long Island teas. And I drove home after the bar closed, and that scared me to death. I was scared to death of getting a DUI. And I'm so glad that I always had that healthy fear, because I never got a DUI. I wouldn't drink and drive. So anyway, while I was still at that first company, I met a man, and we started dating, and I transferred to the new company, and I started working in the group department, and I started training to be a meeting planner, and that's what I did for the rest of my career. I traveled a lot for my job, and my clients were all doctors, MDs and PhDs. And it wasn't socially acceptable to, you know, schmooze with your clients drinking a beer. So I started drinking wine. And there began my career as a wino. That's what I started with, and that's what I ended with. So anyway, I still only drank socially or when I was at work. I got married, had my first child. While I was pregnant with my first child, my grandmother was very ill for that last year, and she died. And she died on my mother's 55th birthday. And 32 days later, my mother died. That really threw my life for a loop, and that's when my drinking career took off. I didn't drink a lot, and I drank at home, but I started drinking after my kids were probably kindergarten, I think, is when I started drinking every day. But, you know, I was a good little wife, a good little worker, and everybody relied on me. I was an operations manager, and I became a vice president in my company, and everybody thought I had my shit together. My husband and I had three different houses. The last house was what I called my McMansion. It was a large house, and we had an in-ground pool. And I drove a brand new car every year, and I was miserable, completely miserable. What I didn't realize until I told my story for the first time this last September, until my sponsor pointed it out to me, that the controlling, narcissistic, sick stepfather that I had growing up, I had married the same man. So once again, I was told I was worthless, not good for anything. I wasn't a good wife. I wasn't a good mother. I wasn't a good cook. I wasn't a good housekeeper. And I had gotten my college degree in basket weaving. So what did I do? I drank at him. And that went on for a number of years. Until 2010, he started having some mysterious illnesses. And he went to doctor after doctor after doctor. And I thought, you know, he's a hypochondriac. And in 2010, he tried to commit suicide three times. And the last time, he did it by drinking antifreeze. He was in a coma for 3 days on life support at Vanderbilt Hospital, and I had had enough. I couldn't deal with it anymore. So I left him. I took the kids and I left him. And for normal people, that would be a sense of relief, and they would probably seek some counseling and get their shit together, but I'm an alcoholic. My drinking took off. I was drinking every day, and I couldn't wait for 5 o'clock. I couldn't wait for 5 o'clock. And then my company got sold, and I had no idea how uncertain my future was. I started working from home. So, you know, drinking at 5:30 or 5:45 or 6 o'clock when I got home from driving home from Bellmead every day. Now I'm at home, and I get off at 4 o'clock. So I'm drinking at 4:05 pretty much every day. Every day. And, you know, for a number of years, you know, and whenever my children were very involved in church and in sports and other activities, and you know, I had that healthy fear of drinking and driving, so I didn't do that. But the guilt that I feel for the time that I didn't connect with my kids, you know, that last year and a half or so of my drinking, you know, I asked my daughter, I don't know, not even a month ago, to describe me then and describe me now. And she said, "Mom, you just checked out. You were there, but you were just checked out." I hid a lot of my drinking from them, but towards the end, there was no hiding, you know. I always had that permanent wine glass in my hand, pretty much. So, in 2012, my ex had a horrendous accident at work, and it almost took off his foot. And, you know, I had a lot of compassion for him still. And I did what I could to help him out. And after about 6 months, he was having to have a lot of surgeries, and he couldn't drive because it was his right foot. And the kids and I moved back in with him, and we lived as roommates. And by that point, I'm crazy, literally, ready for a nervous breakdown. And I go to my doctor and I say, you know, I'm depressed. And he prescribed me an antidepressant, and I had a really bad reaction to it. And my eyes bugged out of my head. I weighed 109 pounds. I'm 5'8", folks. It doesn't look good on me. It freaked my son out. He was 16, 17 at the time. He called my sister. My sister called her husband. He came and picked me up, and he literally had to pick me up. I was so weak. I hadn't, you know, I wasn't eating. I was drinking. But I started taking that antidepressant. I wasn't drinking, but I was taking this antidepressant, and they thought I was on drugs. Anyway, they took me to their house, and he carried me in the house, and she said, "What are you on?" And I told her what I was on. She said, "Well, let's get you off of that, and I'm checking you into Cumberland Heights." And, you know, I walked in there sober, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. It's the best thing that ever happened in my adult life. Because for the first time in my life, I didn't have to be the responsible one. For the first time in my life, I could take a deep breath and say, "I need help." And for the first time in my life, I didn't have to worry about anybody but me for that short amount of time. Now, I was only there for 6 days. My insurance company wouldn't cover me for any longer than that. But again, I did a very smart thing in my exit interview, and I agreed to go to intensive outpatient. And that's what saved my life. So I came into the program, and I was a good little AA-er. I went to meetings. I got a temporary sponsor. And we worked the first three steps. And she's, after 6 months, I think it was, she said, "Tina, you know, I don't know. I just really don't have time to sponsor you, and we need to find you somebody because you need to work these steps and get some relief." She knew how horrendous my home life was. She had met my ex. And she said, you need to work these steps, and you need to do it like now. So I found somebody else, and I asked her to be my sponsor, and she agreed, and I worked the first three steps again, and then life really came at me. I lost my job. I lost my house. My kids were going to now live with my ex for the first time in their lives because, you know, by this point, I'm no longer any use to him. I'm sober. So I'm no longer any use to him. He can't control me anymore. So he leaves with the kids, and I have no place to go. And on top of everything else, I had some really serious health issues that were not related to my drinking. It's a hereditary thing, but my life was a shit show. And I relapsed. What that relapse taught me was a multitude of things, but the most important things were I had not worked that third step. I had not turned my will and my life over to a higher power or to the God of my understanding. I was used to controlling everything. I couldn't trust anybody. I didn't think I could tell anybody. If you asked me, Tina, how you doing? I would say, good. I'm fine. And we all know what fine stands for. Fucked up, insecure, neurotic, emotional. And I was all of that on steroids. So I relapsed. But the second most important thing it taught me was, is going back to that first step. It's not I, it's we. We admitted we were alcoholic and that our lives had become unmanageable. And oh my God, was my life unmanageable? I couldn't do this without you all. It's a we program. And the third thing it taught me was admitting that I needed help. Again. I was humbled. Again. And I needed it. I needed it. I needed to know that I could trust you all to help me. And I needed to know that I didn't have to be good or fine all the time. I could tell you all, I'm not doing well today. I feel like drinking today. My life's unmanageable. Help. I needed to know all of that. So I vowed then and there that I would be willing and teachable. And I don't always do it perfectly, but I try to live that way each and every day now. So I asked my sponsor, tell me how to do it. And she said, you do these five things. You get up, you pray, you read the literature, you go to a meeting, you call, not text, you call three women in this program. And then you pray again before you go to bed. And if you do all those five things and you still have time, then do them again. And I did, because I was going to be willing and teachable. And then I said, well, what do I do now? Well, before I could even get that out of my mouth, two people in the program, that neither one of them, my sponsors, was like, oh, you're not working? Service work. I found my calling. Most of you know me. You know that I do all of these events. That's what I did for a living. I can do that shit with my eyes closed, with my hand tied, not even walking. And a lot of times in this program, I haven't been able to walk. And the first year I was in this program, I had surgery once a month for 12 months. I couldn't drive. I couldn't even get out of the bed, but I could call. I could call and ask you, hey, can I borrow your PA system? Hey, can I borrow your tent? Hey, will you come help serve? Hey, Deborah, will you come help me do decorations with Lisa for the sobriety dinner, the annual sobriety dinner? And most of the time, none of you would say no. I found my calling. So I've learned what used to be my shame in these rooms is not. And in these rooms, I'm a garden variety drunk. I don't have as you've just heard my story, I don't have a drunkalog. I stayed at home and drank. But it doesn't matter. I'm still an alcoholic. So what that you went to the bar? Okay. So what that you got seven DUIs? Okay. I'm still an alcoholic. You're no better, no worse than me. And I'm not here to impress you. I'm here to work my program. And if I do it right, then hopefully you're attracted by that. You know, a lot of people have told me that I'm intimidating. And at first that hurt my feelings. But I no longer apologize for who I am or the program that I work. And Bruce and I were talking about it before the meeting. We were talking about sponsees and, you know, and anybody that's been in here any length of time knows that, you know, you might get one out of, 50 that stick past that third step or past that first 30 days even, you know. But I don't make any excuses for the fact that I work a strong program. And I don't do it perfectly, don't get me wrong. It's progress, not perfection. And there's been times when I have said things to people, and I have just cringed when I got home and thought, why did I say that? But never with any malice. I am a passionate person about certain things. Predators hockey is one of them. Just saying, I'm just throwing that out there. If any of you, a lot of you know, I'm a huge fan. I do most things I do passionately. But it's always been very hard for me to ask for help for me personally. I can ask for donations. I can ask for, you know, your time for the program, but never for me personally. But, you know, what my sponsor told me one day was, Tina, who are you to deny somebody else a service opportunity? Well, when you put it that way, you know. And, you know, I don't mind calling out names in this room because it's a small enough group. Lisa has taken me to the hospital, I can't tell you how many times, and sat with me while I had surgery. You know, I have had some of the best people that I've ever met in these rooms. You taught me how to do it, and hopefully I inspire somebody else how to do it. That's how this program works. You know, having had a spiritual awakening, we try to carry this message to the alcoholic that's out there still sick and suffering. And that's what I try to do. Service work doesn't always have to be, you know, making coffee or sweeping the floors. You know, it can be just calling three people a day, whether you have sponsees or not. And that's what I do. You know, right now I don't have any sponsees. So I do service work in other ways. You know, not everybody's cut out to be a sponsor either. I truly believe that. You can carry the message without, and not the mess. And, you know, the other thing that I've learned is it's okay to not be okay. It's okay for me not to be okay because it's going to change. Every day it's going to change. You know, so I'm having a great week this week. Next week, it's going to be in the shitter. You know, that's just the way it is. You know, and again, anybody that's been in here any length of time knows that. You know, but, and you know, when the promises start, I started seeing, they said when I first got here, don't leave before you hear the, you see the miracle. And I could see the miracles happening for you all. And it happens to each one of us at different times and at different lengths. I also learned that I work the steps at a certain speed, and you may not work at the same speed. And you know what? That's okay. That is perfectly fine. How you work the steps is between you and your sponsor and God, nobody else's business. And that's what my sponsor told me when I said, so-and-so wants to know what step I'm on. And she said, is she your sponsor? And I said, no. And she said, tell her to mind her own business. You know, thankfully, I've had two very strong sponsors. I don't think I could ever have a wallflower. I'm not that kind of person. I'd probably just run right all over her. But I don't. I've had two really good sponsors that were exactly what I needed at that time. And now, you know, my thirst for knowledge of this program is, you know, I think even more so now than when I first got sober. When I first got sober, it was all about just white-knuckling it, and how do I get through another 24 hours, and can I do this? And what this program has taught me is that, and that relapse, that was the third thing that relapse taught me, was that there's nothing in this world, that's going to happen to me that drinking is going to solve. It's just going to make it worse. So when people ask me, you know, how have you gone through your medical issues and not taken a drug or drank? And I said, you know, this is nothing compared to how horrible of an existence I had before I came into this program, before I realized that I always believed in God. I grew up with a God, but I'd never trusted everything with my God, because I had been raised to take on everybody else's responsibilities. You know, as a child, I was head of the household when my mother was working. At work, I was the operations manager. Everybody relied on me. My clients relied on me. They always knew that I was going to, you know, I was always going to do it, and I was going to do it correctly, and they were always going to get the same result. And, you know, and that was good. It was great for many years, and there's nothing wrong with that. That was how I was conditioned. But I have a different employer today, you know. So, I worked, a white-collar job, if you will. Now I clean toilets for a living. I work for myself. I do a lot of different things. And every job I've gotten since I got sober and I lost that job, that all-important job, has been through people in this program. I started out people sitting, an elderly ladies. And then pet set for a while. And then I started cleaning houses and apartments. So I do a little bit of everything now. I've been helping this one lady get her house ready to sell. You know, we're packing her up and, you know, staging it. And, you know, I have one other client that all I do when I go to their house is do their laundry. They don't like doing their laundry. You can pay me all day long to do your laundry. I'm fine with that. I am perfectly fine with that. You know? So, yeah. There are times, I was telling Stephanie at the beginning of the meeting, there are times that, I'm with myself all day, every day, and that's a lot of time in my head. So if I do have something going on, then, you know, it's not such a great thing. That's when I have to really double down, and I may go to a noon meeting and the 5:30, you know, and call my sponsor, you know. I mentioned I have two kids. They're now 20 and 22. My oldest is graduating college next week, and my daughter is ending her sophomore year of college. And I think out of all the steps that I, you know, everybody's always so afraid of doing the fourth step and the fifth step, not me. I wanted all that relief that you guys told me I was going to get. The one that scared me the most, that gave me the most anxiety, was making amends to my children. And for those that know me the most and or know me the best, my children are everything to me. And, you know, it's taken me almost 5 years to, you know, have some of that guilt and shame taken away. You know, you guys told me you were going to love me until I could love myself, and I haven't gotten there yet, but at least today I like myself. I can look in the mirror and actually look at my face in the mirror. You know, before I came into this program, I only looked, you know, just that little bit, you know, women, you know what I'm talking about, just enough to put on, you know. But now I can look at my face in the mirror and say, hey, you know, I can live with that person today. I can live with that person today. I made my amends. And they both, before I could even get it out of my mouth, they said, Mom, it's okay. It's okay. You're a different person today. And like I said, I asked my daughter not too long ago, you know, what I was like then and what I'm like now. And she said, you're very social. You know a lot of people. You do a lot in AA. She comes to a lot of meetings with me. She has from the very beginning. My kids like to see me happy. And AA makes me happy. It makes me happy inside, you know, because it's an inside job. And I have to be happy on the inside before I can be happy on the outside. And before, when I said, I'm good, I'm fine, you know, I don't have a really good poker face, but you guys didn't really know me. Now you know me. and you say, oh, no, you're not fine. We know, don't you, Tim? No, we know. No. And I am a very social person, and I do like to, you know, do things in AA. I actually don't do anything outside my immediate family that doesn't involve AA. Nothing. I work for AA people. I socialize with AA people. I go to meetings, obviously, with AA people. I don't, you know, the only thing I don't do with AA people is sleep with them. That's on you. Anyway, I think that's pretty much it. That's all I got. It's a very unrehearsed. My sobriety date is September the 1st, 2014. It took me 4 years to tell my story. This is only the third time in 4 years I've told my story. And, you know, I was told, Stacy said it the other day when I ran into her at the gym, say a prayer and just get up there and do it. I'm only as sick as my secrets, and I no longer have any secrets, so I'm still sick, but not. But I'm getting well with your help. So anyway, thanks for listening. Thank you.